Now, shall we begin?
At the beginning of this whole thing, I would describe Barry and I both as Christians, conservative Republicans, people who believed the legal system worked, and who believed, frankly, in the death penalty.
I, like most Americans, believed that we had the best judicial system in the world. I thought most of the mistakes were made in letting the bad guy go.
No glory accrues to the state or to its agents when an innocent defendant is acquitted or a wrongfully convicted man is set free. Consider, by way of illustration, the fact that primetime television, such as it is, it's something of an archaic medium now, is utterly clotted with police procedurals. How many of those programs, however, deal with trying to overturn a wrongful conviction? This is rare to the point of invisibility, the only television show I can think of from that genre in which the hero was a defense attorney was Perry Mason. The state's criminal justice system will convict with the zealous haste of Usain Bolt on steroids, but in reversing wrongful convictions, it acts with the torturous sluggishness of a hypothyroid tortoise. And this helps explain why Idaho Falls, Idaho residents Chris Tapp, Lanny Smith, and Michael Whiteley have spent decades in prison for horrible crimes they manifestly did not commit. Bonneville County, Idaho has a population of about 100,000 people, roughly 80% or more of which belong to the Mormon Church. It doesn't have an exceptionally high crime rate, and lurid crimes of violence are not that commonplace. Yet over the course of the last quarter century, you have three documentable wrongful convictions that have occurred involving crimes of that sort. Christopher Tapp, as I've pointed out in previous programs, was convicted of raping and murdering Angie Dodge in June of 1996. Lanny Smith was convicted of murdering Leo and Mary Donnard. They were an elderly couple from Ammon, Idaho, which is sort of a suburb of Idaho Falls, in 1992. Michael Whiteley was found guilty of kidnapping and raping his wife in August of 1991. And in all three of these cases, there was no physical evidence connecting the suspect to the crime. Tapp was manipulated into a false confession after he had been pressured by police investigators to incriminate two friends, Ben Hobbs and Jeremy Sargis. He and his friends were all eliminated as suspects in that murder by DNA testing. Chris Tapp went in for DNA testing in October or November 1996. He wasn't interrogated until December and January, December 1996, January 1997. And it was known to the police investigators that he had been eliminated as a suspect at the time they began interrogating him. During his trial in 1998, the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office treated the jury to carefully edited excerpts from roughly 20 hours of police interrogations. The jury saw an anguished confession by Tapp, but what they didn't see were the critical exchanges in which Tapp was threatened and lied to and manipulated by Jared Furman, the lead investigator of this crime, his supervisor Ken Brown, and by polygraph examiner Steve Finn. Steve Finn convinced this young man that he had to conform his story to what the polygraph machine was supposedly telling him. Tapp was convinced that the polygraph machine had properties similar to the Atavacron from the Star Trek episode All Our Yesterdays. It supposedly was the grand repository of all knowledge and all wisdom, and if he told a story that didn't conform to what the polygraph was supposedly telling Mr. Finn, then Tapp had to change his story. And until he conformed his story to what the polygraph was supposedly telling Detective Finn, Tapp faced the prospect of the death penalty. The only way to save his life, he was told, was by telling the truth as Finn and Furman defined it. The jury didn't see any of this, nor was that critical video evidence provided through discovery to the defense. That evidence was withheld until more than a decade after Tapp's conviction, when it was discovered by Carol Dodge. Carol Dodge is the mother of the late Angie Dodge. She has been indefatigable in investigating this crime for more than 20 years. She is now one of the most ardent supporters of exonerating Chris Tapp. Last Tuesday, September 20th, there was a hearing in Bonneville County on Tapp's most recent appeal. And during that hearing, Deputy Bonneville County Prosecutor John Dewey didn't even pretend that Tapp's conviction was valid. Instead, he insisted that it was simply too late for the wrongfully convicted man to introduce the evidence that would exonerate him, which had been withheld from the jury and from the defense during the prosecution 20 years ago. According to his appellate attorney, Elisa Massoth, Lanny Smith has an IQ of about 69. The prosecution's theory in his case was that in 1992 he murdered his neighbors, Mary Donnard and her husband Leo, out of some bizarrely mutated romantic sexual fixation he had on Mary, who was nearly 70 years old. He supposedly had some kind of a fetish for older, heavyweight women. And in order to validate that theory, they called a woman who broadly fit that description, Beverly Huffaker, another neighbor of Lanny Smith, who claimed that on the night of the murder, that Lanny went to her and tearfully said incriminating things about the murder that had just taken place. The chief problem with that testimony by Beverly Huffaker is that she claimed that it took place after she and her son Scott had returned from a trip to Nevada, where he had won $400 at the gaming tables. He would subsequently spend that $400 on the purchase of a rifle that he had coveted. Those details completely subverted the timeline that the prosecution was urging upon the jury, because a receipt for the purchase of that rifle placed those events 1 month before the murder. There were two other key witnesses against Lanny Smith, one of whom was James Swagger. Mr. Swagger was a suspected child molester, a petty thief, a recidivist criminal, and a jailhouse snitch. Swagger was compelled by the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office and the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office to present perjured testimony against Lanny Smith on the basis of something that Smith supposedly told him when they were sharing a cell together. The other key witness against Lanny Smith was his brother Jeffrey Lynn Smith, who had originally been charged with the crime and who was actually a more plausible suspect, given that he, unlike his brother Lanny, had a very long and very lurid criminal history that included, among other things, acts of assault rape, threats of assault rape, and threats of murder. At least some of the evidence to impeach Jeffrey Smith was presented to the jury, but a great deal of it was excluded by the trial judge, in spite of the fact that it would obviously be relevant in assessing the credibility of Jeffrey Smith as a witness against his brother. The Michael Whiteley case is in some ways the most bizarre of all three of these, and I'll describe it at length in the next segment. You might well ask yourself, why should you care about these incidents from Bonneville County if you don't happen to live there? We're describing, once again, a rural Idaho community of roughly 100,000 people, where violent crime is not particularly commonplace, and where, for the most part, you're dealing with conservative, Republican, religious people. The officials in the Idaho Falls Police Department, the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office, and the Bonneville County Prosecutor's Office are all drawn from that social cohort. These are people who, for the most part, wouldn't cheat at solitaire. They most likely wouldn't take quarters left over at a vending machine or at a payphone, assuming the payphones still exist. They tend to be very scrupulous and very honest in their business dealings. However, when they're invested with this mystical quantity called authority, and given the functional equivalent of immunity in their official capacity, they can, and frequently do, succumb to the temptation to do horrible things, completely convinced of the virtue of what they're doing. Isabel Patterson once described this as the mindset of the humanitarian with the guillotine. She said that most of the evil that is done in the world is done by otherwise good people, and not by accident, lapse, or omission. But rather, it is a deliberate choice that is made by people convinced that they are doing the right thing. And chances are, wherever you live, you're going to encounter people who meet that description if you have the misfortune of being targeted by the so-called justice system. And I will have a great deal more to say about this when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom's Other Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this.
I looked straight at the state's attorney and did something that you should never do. And I simply said, how do you sleep at night?
An Idaho Falls man convicted in 1991 of kidnapping and raping his ex-wife will get a new trial, a judge has ruled, reported the Idaho Falls Post-Register newspaper on January 15, 1997. In the summer of 1991, Michael Dwayne Whiteley, 48, was found guilty of felony first-degree kidnapping and raping his former wife earlier that year. He was sentenced August 12, 1991 to serve 12 years to life in prison. He is serving that time in the Idaho State Penitentiary. Mr. Whiteley is now 63 years old and in failing health. He most likely will die in prison, despite the fact that he manifestly did not commit this crime. There was formidable evidence, as a 7th District judge would rule, that he had been wrongfully convicted. That ruling was handed down in 1997. Whiteley could have avoided prison altogether and served 4 months in jail if he had confessed to the crime, for which neither corroborative eyewitness testimony or physical evidence existed. While reviewing the case for appeal, District Judge Brent Moss ruled January 7th that the evidence against Whiteley was a close case. He granted a request for a new trial and set aside Whiteley's conviction. The judge's ruling states the case rested on the credibility of the ex-wife, Sylvia Canito, who, at a hearing after Whiteley's conviction, refused to answer the defense attorney's questions. Instead, she invoked the Fifth Amendment, which protects against self-incrimination. That's the accuser and the supposed victim pleading the Fifth. The court has been troubled by this case since the petition for post-conviction relief was first filed, wrote Judge Moss. The nature of the relationship between Whiteley and Ms. Candido during the period which gave rise to the charges is difficult to understand and almost impossible to reconcile with testimony, Judge Moss wrote in his order to consider a new trial. Moss also wrote that there was evidence that even while the charges were pending against Whiteley, Candido was willing to remarry him. During the three-day trial in 1991, Candido testified Whiteley entered her car while she was stopped at the 17th Street and Yellowstone Avenue intersection. She said she drove her to his home, where he got a stun gun and handcuffs before driving her to Cedar City, Utah. Mr. Whiteley did possess those items. He had worked as a bail bondsman and bounty hunter in Las Vegas. That is an occupation for which I don't have any particular respect. That fact makes him somewhat less sympathetic from my perspective, but it doesn't mean that he committed the offenses he was charged with. Canito said she was raped 3 times in a motel room in Cedar City, Utah, before she convinced Whiteley to drive her home the next day. She also testified she was raped once more on the way home. In Moss's decision, he states the court may have overlooked the significance of the testimony of Melvin Osborne, who said he saw Whiteley and Canito at a gas station during the alleged kidnapping. Osborne testified that Whiteley introduced Canito to him and that he observed nothing abnormal. This prompted Judge Moss to offer the following observation. Mr. Osborne's observations of Ms. Canito and petitioner, Whiteley, occurred during the actual kidnapping, and raise an inference of innocence. That is, why would the petitioner introduce someone he had kidnapped and raped to anyone who could identify him? Mr. Osborne's testimony, when considered with that of the motel clerk, who observed Canito outside the motel room, may well result in a different verdict. An investigator who worked on the case is upset at his going back to trial. I'm disappointed because I felt he had a fair trial to begin with, said Idaho Falls Police Detective Jared Furman. This story was published on January 15, 1997. Within 2 days, Jared Furman would torture Christopher Tapp into a false confession of murdering Angie Dodge. He's a serial offender. From the Post Register in 1993, we can get a better view of just how peculiar this conviction was. An Idaho Falls man convicted a year ago of kidnapping and raping his ex-wife was convicted on insufficient evidence and should have a new trial, his lawyer told the Idaho Court of Appeals on Wednesday. Michael D. Whiteley, 42, is serving 12 years to life in prison and was represented before the appeals court by Stephen H. Thompson. I don't feel the evidence in this case warranted a conviction, Thompson told the panel of three judges. Mr. Whiteley denies he committed the crimes alleged. Thompson also argued that the prosecutors were allowed to present evidence at the trial that should have been kept out. More importantly, he also said tape-recorded phone calls between the victim and her mother and between the victim and Whiteley should have been provided to the jury while they deliberated. The victim, a Bolivian native, had been in the United States a few months when she met Whiteley in the summer of 1990. She obtained a civil restraining order to keep Whiteley away from her in September of that year. In October, the two were married, but the woman was still married to a Bolivian man whom she was trying to divorce. The marriage was annulled, and in November she obtained another civil restraining order against Whiteley. In a petition for post-conviction relief that Whiteley filed on July 14, 2009, he points out that he didn't receive a lot of the key evidence until March 10, 2001, and in that evidence was a copy of this purported civil protection order. Perhaps through a clerical error, that order said that it would expire on the 6th day of February of 1990. It's entirely possible that it was the intent of the judge to put that expiration date down as February 6th of 1991. That's not what it said in the actual order. On the basis of what's in the written record, that CPO was invalid. It would have expired 344 days prior to the January 16th arrest. Furman materialized on his doorstep, claiming that Whiteley had violated this civil protection order and that he was being arrested for this violation. Whiteley wasn't Mirandized at his home, he wasn't Mirandized at the police station, and it wasn't until the following day he was told he was actually being charged with rape. The taped phone conversations that occurred shortly before the trip to Utah indicate the woman had no fear of Whiteley, Thompson contended. She seemed happy to hear from him, he told the judges. Thompson said the tapes contradict the woman's testimony at trial, and though the jury heard the tapes at trial, they didn't have the tapes available when they deliberated. Thompson said the tapes should have been provided for the jury. He also questioned whether a pair of handcuffs and an electric stun gun found in a duffel bag when police arrested Whiteley were seized legally. In April of 1998, the Idaho State Supreme Court ruled as follows. Because we hold that the evidence presented by Whiteley in the post-conviction proceeding was insufficient to entitle him to relief on the grounds of newly discovered evidence, we reverse the order of the district court awarding a new trial. An April 10, 2008 essay published by the Post Register points out that two letters signed by Sylvia Canito have recanted her testimony. She subsequently denied writing the letters. Bear in mind, this is the woman who took the Fifth Amendment 69 times rather than answer questions posed by Whiteley's defense attorney during the 1996 post-conviction hearing. Seventh District Judge Brent Moss, reviewing the full evidence, said that he was left with an uneasy feeling that justice was not served by the original verdict and that a new trial was appropriate. A commutation hearing before the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole would be the closest thing to the new trial Whiteley never received. The entire case, including the severity of former 7th District Judge Marv Smith's sentence, 12 years to life, could be considered. Several jurors at Whiteley's trial said they were stunned by how harshly he was punished. Had Whiteley admitted guilt and accepted a plea bargain, he might have been out of jail in 4 months, or possibly more successful in winning parole later. Idaho Governor Butch Otter, of course, has the power of commutation. He's not inclined to exercise it. Summarizes this essay, It is the political system's way to check for mistakes in the courts. Before Whiteley completes his life sentence, wouldn't it be fair to settle whether he deserves it? There is a very strong institutional prophylaxis within the state's so-called justice system that is designed to impede accountability on the part of officials, police, prosecutors, and judges, who have abused innocent people. I'll be back in just a minute. I have previously mentioned Lanny Smith and his unjust conviction for the 1992 double murder of Leo and Mary Downard of Ammon, Idaho. When that investigation began, as I pointed out previously, Lanny's brother Jeffrey Lynn Smith was the original suspect. The case against Lanny Smith involved no definitive physical evidence that connected the defendant to that crime. The prosecution placed great emphasis on a single tennis shoe footprint found in the dust in the Downards' master bedroom. It was never adequately measured in order to determine the size of that shoe. Both Lanny and Jeffrey possessed FootJoy tennis shoes of that type. Lanny apparently wore a size 8.5. We don't know what size shoe Jeffrey Smith wore because he testified before the grand jury that he wore an 8.5, and then later, at trial, testified that he wore a size 9.5. This is a matter of some critical significance, because the prosecution, using a mathematical model to compensate for the photograph that was taken by incompetent crime scene investigators. Bonneville County Sheriff's Detective Victor Rodriguez was the lead investigator at the site. They took a photograph of that footprint, that dust print, from an angle which distorted the size of the footprint, apparently. They didn't put a ruler down next to the footprint, as standard protocol would dictate, in order to establish the size of the footprint, so they hired an expert mathematician from the Idaho Nuclear Engineering Laboratory who devised a very dubious mathematical model that supposedly compensated for the distortions in his copy of the photograph. He didn't have the negative, he had a copy of the photograph, in order to determine what size that footprint was. And it was supposedly a size 8.5. On at least two occasions, Jeffrey Smith had testified that he owned and wore size 8.5 FootJoy tennis shoes. He was allowed to correct that testimony after meeting in the hallway with Detective Rodriguez. He was originally arrested in 1992 and then released after the grand jury was convinced that there was inadequate evidence to connect him to the crime. Lanny Smith, for whatever reason, within a couple of years, had been identified as the suspect. The prosecution's theory, as I mentioned before, was that Lanny had some kind of a sexual fixation on older women of ample carriage. I've mentioned previously the testimony of Beverly Huffaker, who told the police that Lanny had admitted to her that he had visited the home of the victims on the day of the murder, in spite of the fact that Jeffrey Smith was the last known visitor, something that he was forced to admit, on the day of the murder. She claimed that during the early hours of March 22, 1992, she and her son Scott had heard Lanny Smith say that something bad had happened to the Downards. As I mentioned previously, they connected that incident to a trip they had taken to Nevada, where Scott had won $400 that he used to buy a rifle on the following day. However, the defense was able to locate a receipt for the rifle, proving that the purchase had occurred in February, which was several weeks prior to the murder. In order to supplement this bizarre theory of the case, the prosecution presented the testimony of a jailhouse snitch named James Swagger. Swagger learned about the impending trial of Lanny Smith and told investigators that he would be willing to testify against the defendant in exchange for certain considerations. To be specific, he wanted to have a charge of lewd and lascivious conduct with a minor thrown out. Failing that, he wanted to be taken to a more secure environment. He was, after all, an accused child molester. He was also facing several counts of theft. On May 14th of 1994, shortly before the trial was scheduled to begin, Swagger wrote a letter to Detective Rodriguez in which he recanted his story that Lanny had confessed to him. "Please do not continue to harass me," Swagger demanded. "If I am forced to take the stand, you will regret the words out of my mouth, because I will have to tell the truth, which is, I do not know a thing. So you and everyone else should leave me the hell alone." The prosecution was painfully aware of the inadequacy of their case, and so they called Swagger to the stand anyway. During a preliminary hearing, Swagger, for whatever reason, repented of his recantation. He insisted not only that Lanny had murdered the couple, but engaged in a post-mortem sexual assault on Mary's lifeless body. That's a claim for which no physical evidence was taken. There had been rumors circulated within the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office that the sheets on the bed in the master bedroom where the murder occurred appeared to be stained with semen, but that evidence was never collected because, once again, of the Olympian ineptitude of Bonneville County Sheriff's Detective Victor Rodriguez, who now lives, I understand, in Nampa. The trial judge, for whatever reason, denied the defense's motion in limine against Swagger's testimony, and so the prosecution, once again in a gesture that I think underscores the abject poverty of their case, put Swagger on the stand, and he rehearsed to the jury his aberrant claim that Lanny had raped the dead victim, referring to this as his trump card. Lanny's defense counsel introduced another letter Swagger had written to the trial judge in his pending criminal case, threatening not to testify unless he received leniency. "If you are not willing to agree to these terms, then you should seriously reconsider calling me for my testimony," Swagger informed the judge. "And don't bother sending a transport for me to come before the trial, because unless I have one of the terms in writing by the proper authorities, I will not come, no matter what you do to me or how much time you give me." Several years ago, Swagger was contacted by an investigator working for Lanny Smith's appellate counsel, Elisa Masuth. He once again denied any knowledge of the murders. In the event that Smith were to be granted a new trial, it would be relatively easy to find Mr. Swagger because he was convicted on drug and theft charges in Marion County, Oregon last June 22nd and is currently in the custody of the Oregon state prison system. Perhaps the key prosecution witness in this burlesque of a trial of Lanny Smith was Jeffrey Smith, who was the original suspect in the double murder. When questioned by defense counsel about Jeffrey Smith's credibility, Detective Rodriguez insisted that Jeffrey was no longer considered a suspect despite the fact that Rodriguez had told the grand jury that Smith has a background of wife abuse and physical abuse. During the case in chief, Rodriguez was asked if he still regarded Smith to be dangerous, and he replied, "I don't believe so." That was a conscious lie, one of many that Detective Rodriguez told. A report he filed with the prosecution in October of 1993 warned that Jeffrey Smith had displayed acts of violence on his two ex-wives, even to the point of holding a gun to their heads. At the time, Smith was awaiting trial on a statutory rape charge, and all of this was withheld from the jury during Lanny Smith's trial. The prosecutor, incidentally, in introducing Jeffrey Smith's testimony, said that Smith had been a victim and he was there to clear his name. That's an act of vouching on behalf of a witness, which is black-letter prosecutorial misconduct. Shortly after Lanny was convicted, his appellate counsel received a written statement from a woman named Jamie Lynn Hill, who had been threatened by Smith when she intervened during a domestic dispute between Smith and an ex-wife. What Smith said specifically was, "You better back down, little girl, or I'll take care of you just like I took care of that old Ammon couple," which was a reference to the Downards. There was a report filed with the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office on March 18th of 1994. That's more than a year before the trial of Lanny Smith was to begin. Just a few weeks ago, Eliza Masuth, the appellate attorney for Lanny Smith, who's been writing this case now for about 8 years, filed yet another petition for relief with the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In her 125-page brief, she outlines in some detail some newly discovered evidence recently provided to her through belated discovery. Among the things she mentions is a 20,000-page collection of investigative materials that the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office had not provided to the defense. Within that expansive collection are newly discovered documents detailing Jeff Smith's violent behavior and history with law enforcement. These documents included a Bonneville County Sheriff's General Offense Report from August 4, 1990, reporting threats of violence against Robin Smith by her husband, Jeff Smith. Robin reported that Jeff threatened to blow her head off with a .22. An Idaho Falls Police Crime Report from July 26, 1993, reporting threats and extortion against Robin Smith by her then ex-husband, Jeff Smith. An Idaho Falls Police Complaint from 1986, reporting Jeff Smith attempting to break into his ex-wife Julie Smith's house. An Idaho Falls Police Complaint report from 1986, reporting Jeff Smith calling his ex-wife Julie Smith and threatening to kill her. An Idaho Falls Police General Offense report dated June 15, 1986, in which Julie Smith reported that Jeff had grabbed her by the throat and held her against the living room wall and grabbed a knife from the kitchen after Julie fought back. A Bonneville County Sheriff's Office General Offense Report, wherein Robin Smith reported being afraid to go home for fear of being beaten by her husband, Jeff Smith. Police escorted her home to retrieve some personal items. This was the key witness in a double murder trial, arising from a case in which he had been the primary suspect. I'll be back in just a minute.
If you didn't see the Central Park 5 documentary, go see that. When I saw that, I only had like 4 years on the job at the time. So I was just learning. You are the perpetrator. You don't know you're the perpetrator because they're not going to tell you you're the perpetrator. Keep your damn mouth shut. This is what I tell the young folks. That if that was to happen to you, as you're walking, you say, "Officer, am I under arrest?" "No, you're not under." "Well, then I must be free to leave." And then you start to leave.
It is both an ethics violation and a crime for a prosecutor to withhold evidence from the defense during the discovery process, but it is all but impossible to find an example of a post-conviction case in which a prosecutor who has done so has been sanctioned for that behavior. This is why, as Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has said, we are seeing an epidemic of Brady violations nationwide. Brady versus Maryland is the Supreme Court ruling that deals with the constitutional obligation of the prosecution to produce any exculpatory evidence or potentially exculpatory evidence to the defense. In December of 2013, a panel from the Ninth Circuit refused the appeal of Kenneth Olson, who had been convicted by a federal jury of knowingly developing a biological agent for use as a weapon. There were two pillars of the prosecution's case, each of which was fractured at its base and thoroughly compromised within. The first was an extensive, or one might say Orwellian, review of Olson's online activity. Nestled within 20,000 pages of records obtained by the feds, were found a number of searches related to topics such as how to kill, silent death, getting even, death by poison, and similar subjects. The second pillar of the case against Olson was expert testimony from Arnold Melnikoff, a forensic scientist with the Washington State Police, who insisted that a bottle of allergy pills that had been found among Olson's effects had been spiked with ricin, a deadly poison derived, if I remember correctly, from castor beans that can be quite easily made and with little expense. Olson's defense counsel observed, correctly, that there was considerable evidence that Melnikoff handled and extensively manipulated the pills before delivering them to the FBI, which confirmed his findings. Melnikov admitted that he had unceremoniously dumped the pills onto a laboratory bench that had been contaminated with ricin. This meant that it was impossible to determine if the ricin had been insinuated into the pills or if the pills had merely acquired a patina of that substance after being spread on Melnikov's contaminated workstation. At the time of the Olson trial, Melnikov was being investigated by the Washington State Police for misconduct involving courtroom testimony and/or his case analysis. In his previous role as head of the Montana State Crime Laboratory, an inept hair sample analysis carried out by Melnikov had led to a wrongful conviction of Jimmy Ray Bromgaard, who spent 15 years in prison for supposedly raping an 8-year-old girl before he was exonerated by a DNA analysis. Washington State's investigation also discovered two more wrongful convictions in Melnikov's background, which led to his termination. An appellate court ruled that he was incompetent and had committed gross misconduct. The assistant U.S. attorney in charge of prosecuting Kenneth Olson was aware of all of this, and the existence of a Washington State Police report documenting Melnikov's egregious and habitual misconduct. Instead of providing this information to the defense, as he was required to under Brady, the prosecutor committed the offense of misprision of perjury by allowing the examiner's defense attorney to misrepresent the investigation on the witness stand. The singularly incurious trial judge ruled that Olson's defense attorney would not be allowed to cross-examine Melnikov, who at the time had been placed on administrative leave in Washington regarding the ongoing investigation into his professional misconduct. As a result, summarized Judge Kaczynski in a justifiably caustic dissent to that December 2013 ruling, the government introduced the spiked allergy pills and the jury heard Melnikov's testimony all without ever being informed of these serious doubts about their reliability. As Kaczynski observed, the prosecutor stood before the district judge and uttered falsehoods about the Washington State Police investigation into Melnikov's misconduct. This matters not, insisted the Ninth Circuit Court majority, since the jury might have convicted Olson solely on the basis of the material provided through government scrutiny of his extensive internet activity, which did not yield evidence of actual intent to commit a criminal act against any identified individual. Note how the standard they're employing after the fact is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but rather speculation as to a ruling the jury might have made on the basis of inadequate evidence. The court's ruling against Olson is not just wrong, it is dangerously broad, carrying far-reaching implications for the administration of criminal justice, wrote Kaczynski. It effectively announces that the prosecution need not provide exculpatory or impeaching evidence so long as it's possible the defendant would have been convicted anyway. This will send a clear signal to prosecutors that, when a case is close, it's best to hide evidence helpful to the defense, as there will be a fair chance reviewing courts will look the other way, as happened here. Lamentably, the Ninth Circuit Court is the federal court of immediate appeal for Lanny Smith, as well as for Chris Tapp and Michael Whiteley. On September 16th of 2011, notes the 125-page habeas brief filed on behalf of Lanny Smith in August, Lanny filed his third motion for discovery, in which he asked to depose James Swagger, who had recanted the snitch testimony he had provided at Lanny's trial, and an in-camera review of the state's work product and access to Rodriguez's files. Lanny's constitutional due process right to a fair trial was violated when the trial court allowed the state to put on the entirely unreliable testimony from jailhouse snitch James Swagger, a person they knew lied. The state failed to disclose Brady information about Swagger, and trial counsel failed to impeach Swagger's testimony with his motive to lie out of anger toward Lanny's sister. That is an issue which is not developed in this brief, and I certainly wish it had been. Moreover, the court erred in denying Lanny's request to depose Swagger after Swagger recanted his testimony. In September 2011, Swagger responded to a letter sent by defense counsel after the Idaho Innocence Project located Swagger using its database. Swagger contacted habeas counsel and recanted his testimony. Swagger stated that he obtained some general background based on what Lanny told him the police were saying. He felt he could avoid prison time if he found a way to assist the state in prosecuting Lanny. He then wrote directly to Rodriguez, who filled him in with details of the crimes. In recanting, Swagger stated that Lanny never told him he had killed the Downards, and never told him he had raped Mrs. Downard. Swager did not believe that Lanny committed the murders, or that he had the intellectual capacity to do so. Bear in mind, this is a man with an IQ of 69. He believes Lanny is innocent and can no longer live with having put an innocent man in prison. After interviewing with Rodriguez several times, Swager decided he did not want to testify. That's reflected in the contemporaneous letters he sent to Rodriguez and to the trial judge, and to the judge in his own impending trial on child sexual abuse charges. However, Rodriguez and the prosecutors told him that if he did not testify against Lanny, he would be prosecuted for the same crime as Lanny and would face the same potential sentence, death, as Lanny. Where have we heard that before? That is a variation on what was done to Chris Tapp by the sister agency of the Bonneville County Sheriff's Office, the Idaho Falls Police Department. They share an office space, and obviously they share tactics. Because he was afraid and believed that he would be charged and punished, he testified against Lanny. Just prior to his testimony, the prosecution promised Swager he would be transferred. After trial, Swager was sentenced in Oregon on an unrelated charge. However, in 1996, he returned to Idaho to serve out his Idaho sentence. The state arranged for his transfer with the Idaho Department of Corrections, and he was transferred to Nevada. While in Idaho, he had been held in isolation. His sentence in Nevada was served in general population. That is the quid pro quo. On September 12th of 2011, Swager recanted his testimony to habeas counsel. Swager expressed concern that the state would retaliate against him for coming forward. After hearing the recantation, habeas counsel filed a motion on September 16th, 2011 to depose him in shortened time. On September 22nd, 2011, the district court denied the motion to shorten time. On March 3rd, 2012, the district court denied the request to depose Swager, along with dismissing remaining claims in the amended petition. They're saying that his recantation is not valid because it's unsworn testimony, and then they denied permission to depose him under oath in order to prevent that evidence from being presented in order to redress an obviously wrongful conviction. In our so-called criminal justice system, careers are made through convictions. They're not made by acquitting the innocent. And it matters not whether the convicts are materially innocent or guilty of the crimes with which they've been charged from the perspective of careerists who profit from feeding people into the carceral apparatus of the regime. Once people are convicted, the state will do everything within its formidable power to preserve that conviction, whether or not it is just, because there is no actual justice in the so-called justice system. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, dum spirito pugna. While I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and maybe send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.